weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the
This is the Quality News Network. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice thanked the Syrian government for thwarting an attempted attack on the U.S. Embassy in Damascus today. Syrian security forces killed 3 of 4 armed Islamic militants, as well as a Syrian anti-terrorist. 9 states are holding primaries today. One of the most closely watched is Rhode Island, where Lincoln Chafee, the only Republican senator to vote against the Iraq War, faces a tough challenge for renomination. Across Iraq today, 24 people were killed in scattered violence, including bombings and gunfire. Meanwhile, officials debated a bill that would set a timetable for the withdrawal of foreign troops. That proposal was shelved for further review. Debate was also put off for another proposal that would work toward establishing autonomous regions in the country. In Iran, visiting Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki asked Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to help stem the flow of al-Qaeda militants into Iraq. In other negotiations, Ahmadinejad offered to help Iraq improve its security and stability. The two men meet again tomorrow. In southern Afghanistan, NATO forces have taken back territory from Taliban insurgents. Hundreds of suspected militants were killed in the 11-day operation. In the northern part of the country, coalition troops killed a militant leader and wounded several others after coming under attack. NATO Secretary General is asking the 26 member nations to send 2,500 more troops. In Lebanon, the environment minister estimates it will take a decade to clean up the oil spill, destroying the country's coastline if 1,000 people work in it continuously. Only 40 volunteers are mopping up the oil, which gushed into waters following an Israeli bombing of a chemical plant. A federal study concludes that despite the fact that many Gulf War veterans suffer from what seems to be the same medical problems, there is no such thing as Gulf War syndrome. The report will help determine the type and amount of benefits those veterans are eligible for. In London, a group of teachers, psychologists, and authors say British children are being forced to grow up too fast. The group blames an influx of junk food, computer games, and an increasingly competitive education system. In California, researchers released a study today that says humans are largely responsible for increasingly powerful hurricanes. They say ocean temperatures are rising because of higher levels of greenhouse gases. You're listening to QNN.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
The U.S. trade deficit hit a record $68 billion in July, largely due to higher oil prices. BP says it plans to ask the U.S. Transportation Department for approval to reopen part of its Alaska pipeline. However, safety tests must be conducted first. Bristol-Myers Squibb CEO Peter Dolan has been fired. That follows a federal investigation into the company's efforts to block a Canadian company from producing generic versions of Plavix. Canon is recalling nearly 2 million personal copiers because of a fire hazard. The company is offering a free inspection and replacement part. The computers at risk include 11 models manufactured between 1987 and 1997. Chicago's mayor vetoed a measure that would have required the city's big box stores to pay its hourly workers at least $10 an hour plus $3 in benefits by the year 2010. But California will see an increase in its minimum wage starting January 1st. A bill was signed into law today that raises it by $1.25 to $8 an hour. Global staffing firm Manpower, Inc. released a survey today that says 28% of U.S. companies plan to hire more people in the fourth quarter. At the close of Wall Street today, the Dow was up 101 points at 11,498, NASDAQ up 43 points at 2215, S&P 500 up 14 at 1313. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
Any well-functioning...
Now, Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it, so call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
The magistrates are serving the people and are all time amenable to them. We the people exercise our sovereignty. Several ways. One, of course, is the ballot box. We determine who shall serve us and who shall make our laws. We exercise our sovereignty through instructions to our representatives and through our speech that we engage in trying to bring other people around to our points of view. Not surprisingly, we find constitutional protection for these exercises of sovereignty. Most notably, the First Amendment provides for freedoms of speech, press, association, and the right to petition. And in his landmark decision in New York Times versus Sullivan, Justice Brennan in 1964 described this amendment's central meaning as that of implementing the notion of the people are the sovereign. We also have created various due process and equal protection doctrines that promote the people as sovereign. To perform our functions as the sovereign, as the ruler, we the people need information. We need access to what's going on in government. We have an entitlement to it, since we are the sovereigns, we are the rulers, and the people in the government are our servants. It follows from that that the default position with regards to access for information held by the government is that the information should be available to the sovereign, to the people. The second function of openness is that it is a fundamental component of our separation of powers and our system of checks and balances. That system, of course, includes checks by the legislature and the executive by legislature and courts on the executives, and it includes checks that the press serves and that the citizens themselves serve. Here again, the First Amendment provides us with this checking function. By allowing the press to investigate the government and to keep us informed about what's going on in the government and, of course, to uncover governmental abuses. The Fourth Amendment provides a judicial check on the executive's ability to conduct searches and seizures. And Articles 1, 2, and 3 of the Constitution provide an elaborate scheme of distributed and shared powers to ensure that no one branch of government aggrandizes too much power. Although there is a message we'd probably like to send to Congress here, and that is another premise of this system is that when we give the branches powers, we expect them to use them, something Congress is losing sight of. The Bush administration, by all accounts, and by some specific numbers that I can point you to, has become the most closed administration in modern history, if not in our entire national history. The 9/11 Commission, for example, recently the 9/11 Co-Commission, the 9/11 Commission co-chairs spent an entire book outlining how the Bush administration stonewalled the Commission's effort to gather information that would help it write its report, including repeated refusals by
President Bush and Vice President Cheney to testify before the commission. And then at one point, George said, well, I'll only come in if I can bring Dick with me. I'm not sure what the message there was, but it's a White House, too, which has certainly created a reputation of being very stingy with information, at least when you're not talking about the names of CIA agents who are on the outs. A report out this month from an organization called OpenTheGovernment.org, a document entitled Secrecy Report Card 2006, cited a variety of criteria indicating the escalating secrecy of our government. A particularly telling number is that in the last two fiscal years, our government has spent, on average, $141 to create new secrets and keep old secrets for every $1 it spent declassifying materials. That compares to what the Clinton administration spent in its last 4 years of about $20 to classify as opposed to declassify information, 20-to-1 ratio, at least seven times higher creating new secrets as what we used to spend. These figures, by the way, do not include the expenditures the CIA makes to classify documents because the government has classified what the CIA spends on its budget, so we can't get that information. There has, in addition, been an increasing practice by agencies to create what are called SBUs, sensitive but unclassified labels. We now have over 50 of them, and only 17 of them have been authorized by Congress. Another development that has sort of snowballed with this administration is the invocation of the state secrets doctrine, which the Bush administration has become quite enamored with. That doctrine says that in civil litigation, the government may be excused from disclosing classified information, even though it's highly relevant to the litigation at hand, and even though it will make or break the plaintiff's case. And indeed, if state secrets are so much a part of the case and so intertwined with the cause of action, it may well be that the case gets thrown out in its entirety, which recently happened to a CIA agent who claimed race discrimination against the agency, and the case could not go forward because of the risk of disclosing secrets. The doctrine is not seriously challenged, but it was also rarely invoked. In the 23 years between 1953 and 1976, for example, at the height of the Cold War, the doctrine had been invoked but six times. That's 1 year's output for this administration. It is invoking state secrets as a defense at a rate of twice that of preceding four administrations. And it's very convenient for the government to do because federal judges do not want to be the ones who are going to be tagged with the responsibility for revealing state secrets. And indeed, in a case here in West Virginia, the government threatened to do that involving a couple up in Morgantown who were fired without notice, without reason, never given an explanation for their firing, even though they had a long-time, excellent work record. They had to sue. The government still stonewalled. 2 years later, we're finally getting to some of the information in the case. And despite the government's contention that state secrets were involved, it's clear right now that that was a fancy of federal, a flight of federal fancy. Where we can really see the consequences of governmental secrecy, however, I think is in the area of government surveillance programs. It is, of course, true that in fighting crime, and certainly in fighting terrorism, the default rules on disclosure are going to be different. You cannot have an effective government program fighting terrorism if it has to open its files up to the public. I mean, clearly, the government has to have secrets in this area. But the Constitution takes that into account. The Fourth Amendment protects us from unreasonable search and seizures, and so in determining whether a particular search is unreasonable, we consider what the governmental purposes are and what the governmental interests are. We create alternative devices to limit the discretion that government has in making judgments about our civil liberties. But this administration is advocating and has in fact implemented programs that would in effect eliminate even the most minimal checks that we normally provide for foreign intelligence gathering. A brief background on the law here. In 1968, the Supreme Court, for the first time, held that the government had to get warrants to conduct wiretap searches. Prior to that time, there had to be a physical search. The Supreme Court changed the law there and said reasonable expectations of privacy is what we look at. You have an expectation of privacy in your phone calls, and the government therefore can't intrude on them without a warrant. 3 years later, in a case, United States versus U.S. District Court, the Supreme Court decided that even if the president has determined that national security interests at stake, he still has to get a warrant to conduct a wiretapping of domestic conversations. So that even as something that important cannot excuse the warrant requirement. It left open the question, however, of whether warrants would be required for foreign intelligence gathering when you have foreign governments involved. Congress in 1979 then enacted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, and in that sort of balance, what are the competing interests with regards to foreign intelligence gathering and civil liberties, and thus created the FISA courts, which were secret courts, which would decide questions about warrants in foreign intelligence gathering cases. The government had a lesser standard than normal criminal process kind of cases to get a warrant, but they still had to go get one. You still had to have a judge to talk to. The Patriot Act amended that, lowered the standard somewhat, gave the government a little bit more leeway, but still kept the warrant requirement in there. And the government's done quite well with the FISA court. Since 1980, there have been about 20,000 applications for wiretaps with regards to foreign intelligence. Four have been rejected. So basically, if the government goes there, the court's going to give it to them. And we're increasing every year the number of these FISA orders. They are now at a rate of about twice what they were in 2000. That is not necessarily a bad thing. It means our government is out there looking for terrorists, you know, and we want them to be doing that. And it could be we've just stepped up the program somewhat. What we don't want, however, is what we've gotten in addition to FISA. Thanks to leaks which came out at the end of last year, that's the only way we seem to get information, we have learned what a federal judge in Michigan has called the TSP, the secret program. The fact that the National Security Administration has been operating a warrantless wiretapping program since at least 2002. And under this program, the National Security Administration has been monitoring domestic phone calls, calls between people in the United States, including U.S. citizens and including people who are here legally as aliens, and has been wiretapping their phone calls without warrants if the government, quote, has reason to believe that the party on the other end is out of the country and is a member of, is affiliated with, is a member of an organization affiliated with, or is working to support Al-Qaeda or similar terrorist organizations. Unlike FISA, which has minimal procedures, but they have some, unlike FISA, the TSP has no warrant requirement, no time limits with regards to the length of surveillance, no notice requirement, and no reporting requirement to Congress. It basically has no checks, no judicial or congressional oversights or checks. A federal judge last month in Michigan declared that the program violated the Fourth Amendment, protection against unreasonable search and seizures, the First Amendment, the FISA itself, and separation of powers. The government's arguments were that, one, the plaintiffs didn't have standing in the case because they couldn't prove that they were in fact being subjected to the act because they couldn't get the information because of the state secrets doctrine. And second, the court rejected that. The second argument is the one the Bush administration has been going back to constantly, and that is that the congressional authorization for the use of military force to pursue Al-Qaeda basically justifies any means whatsoever, foreign or domestic, to pursue Al-Qaeda. The administration has more recent, of course, these all got struck down. The courts have also struck down some other Bush programs, so the administration has come back seeking congressional authorization to do exactly what they've been doing, to resume the NSA programs with the warrantless wiretaps, to make FISA optional, give the government the choice of whether they want to go get a warrant, and most recently, to conduct trials of individuals who have been held in, of course, secret prisons for the last several years, without a right of confrontation, without a right to even attend portions of it, and in some cases without a right to even see the evidence. And unbelievably, some chuckleheads in Congress are buying this. The Bush administration's response to all this is basically, trust us. You know, we'll do right by you. Well, I don't know. You'd have to trust Donald Rumsfeld, you know, Karl Rove, Alberto Gonzalez. I mean, I don't feel much consolence here. But the real point here is that the Constitution, including our Bill of Rights, is a carefully constructed framework with built-in barriers against tyranny of all kinds. And when the government operates outside that framework, it brushes aside those checks and balances. It creates an environment that invites and facilitates serious abuse. And from the reports we get about Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, indefinite suspension of citizens, and on, it appears the framers were right. There is a vital need for these checks and balances, and good reasons not to trust this government. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Professor Chuck Smith. Chuck is professor and chair of the Political Science Department at West Virginia State University. He holds a BA degree in political science from West Virginia State University, an MA degree in political science from the University of New Mexico, and a PhD in political science from the University of Kentucky. Chuck was a member of the Hate Crimes Task Force, served on the Human Rights Commission Planning Committee, served on the board of directors of the Catholic Community Service, the West Virginia Lesbian and Gay Coalition, and the American Civil Liberties Union of West Virginia. He is currently doing research for his new book, True American Revolutionaries. Chuck was named to the National Advisory Council of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State in 2004, which takes us to his topic, Faith-Based Initiatives and the Separation of Church and State.
On January 20th, 2001, like many Americans, I watched the television coverage of George Bush's inauguration. His inaugural address, of course, raised concerns about policy implications of the ideals and goals that he proposed. This neither surprised me nor upset me. On the political spectrum, after all, I'm about as far from, as one can get from the president. Near the end of his speech, he said, "Some needs and hurts are so deep they will only respond to a mentor's touch or a pastor's prayer. Church and charity, synagogue and mosque, lend our communities their humanity." And then he said, and we will have an honored place in our plans and in our laws for them. These words hit me like a slap in the face. To me, that statement amounted to a declaration of war on a core American value, the liberty of conscience, religious liberty. The clear constitutional principle that government is prohibited from involving itself in religion. I braced myself for what I imagined would be an unrestrained effort to entangle government and religion. Unfortunately, the actions of the Bush White House have exceeded anything that I could have dared to imagine. I don't have time to catalog or describe all the various methods and numbers of times the Bush administration has ignored or pitched aside the constitutional protections for religious liberty. Tonight, I'm going to quickly identify and provide a few examples of the ways the government has abridged religious freedom. And then I will conclude with an example of one of the administration's most egregious attempts to impose its religious standards on Americans. Bush entered the presidency with the militant support and ringing endorsement of the religious right, which was one of the most significant factors in his electoral win in 2000. More importantly, though, the president resonates with the Christian conservative goal of giving religion an official place in government. This has long been an objective of some Christian groups. During the better part of the mid-1800s, the National Reform Association lobbied for the government to embrace and acknowledge Christianity as Americans' religion. In the 20th century, the religious right has done much the same thing, but with a very important difference. In the 19th century, such movements condemned the founders of the Republic for creating a secular government. Today, the religious right argues that the founders, in fact, established a government favoring and honoring the Christian religion, and that Christians' place of preeminence was stolen in the mid-20th century by the courts. During the early weeks of his administration, President Bush made it clear that he intended to correct this perceived distortion of the nature of American government. He made his faith-based initiatives a centerpiece of his policy agenda. When Congress failed to enact these programs, Bush issued executive orders to create the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives in the White House and created faith-based offices in seven federal agencies. Although the administration publicly touts the image of religious pluralism, the practice is something quite different. In October 2003, the White House Conference on Faith-Based Community Initiatives was held in Memphis. Of the 1,600 participants, all were members of Christian organizations. In the workshops on how to obtain federal grants, the message was quite clear. In a USAID workshop, for example, a presenter, Phil Reed, whose group had previously successfully obtained a grant, explained, "Our mission was to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ throughout the world. We put that in our proposal and said, if we don't get funded, so be it. And we got the money. No longer do you need to compromise your faith to get federal funding. If you want a Bible verse to wrap around that, if Cyrus wants to give money to God to build God's kingdom, we'll take it." The Bush administration accepted whole cloth the religious right's contention that the Establishment Clause does not prohibit the government from promoting religion, but merely disallows it from endorsing a particular religion. In doing this, the administration ignored more than 60 years of recognized constitutional law to the contrary. Moreover, the administration has given government de facto recognition to conservative Christianity as the preeminent religion of the land. Another point, shepherding political infidels into the Republican sheepfold. The administration has used faith-based initiatives as the cornerstone of its efforts to gain the votes of African Americans. According to news reports, officials from the White House Faith-Based Initiative Office appeared in Republican Party events in six states during the fall 2002 election. Jeremy White, the outreach director for the faith-based program, addressed a group of mostly 300 African American ministers in South Carolina and told of the millions of dollars, federal tax dollars, going to churches through the initiative. After that event, the Republican Party sent letters to those attending the conference explaining how they could get grant forms to apply for the grants. A reporter asked White if targeting the black ministers was an effort to aid Bush's electoral plans. "Definitely not," he said. "We haven't targeted any specific area. We targeted the whole country." Republican pollster Frank Luntz, however, characterized the president's faith-based initiative as something quite different. He said, "It's the first successful effort I've seen to penetrate the black mindset." Another point, politicizing the church. The religious right has long complained of IRS restrictions on electioneering by tax-exempt organizations. They claim it is an abridgment of their constitutional right to free exercise of religion. They claim that churches and ministers have the right to teach anything they want, including supporting or opposing political public policy and endorsing political candidates and political parties. This, of course, is correct. But churches, like other groups who apply for tax-exempt status, agree not to engage in electoral politics. Congress reviews tax exemption as a privilege, not as a right. Nevertheless, Bush's allies in the House of Representatives have been promoting a House of Worship Freedom Act, which would allow religions to maintain tax-exempt status and engage in partisan and electoral politics. The proposed legislation allows only religious groups to do so, though. All other tax-exempt organizations would still be prohibited from engaging in electoral politics. Another point. Ignoring the liberty of conscience to promote fundamentalist morality. Wrapping itself in religious sanctimony, the President and his allies in Congress have sought to control and restrict some of the most significant private personal decisions made by individual citizens. The Bush administration has an inordinate interest in and concern with the reproductive and sexual practices of Americans. It has actively discouraged the use of condoms and denied their effectiveness in limiting the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. It has accepted the assessment of the religious right that condoms do not present a barrier to STD viruses and that they should not be used because they unnaturally prevent conception. Evidently, the demonic pores in the latex condoms expire, or rather expand, to allow STD viruses to escape and contract to contain the spermatozoa to prevent contraception. The administration promotes abstinence-only programs as its preferred method of avoiding unwanted pregnancies and transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. It has funded educational programs such as the Silver Ring Thing, which are essentially teaching the specific sexual ethics and theological views of fundamental Christianity. Only after the ACLU filed a lawsuit challenging this practice did the government stop funding this program. President Bush clearly wants to define the define the limits of legal access to reproductive health by theological standards of fundamentalist Christianity. I would like to conclude with discussing the unfortunate case of Terry Schiavo. The activities of the President and his allies in Congress to impose extremist fundamentalist values on decisions about Ms. Schiavo's end of life demonstrate the degree to which they are willing to make public policy conform to their theology. This case is a prime example of the extent of the influence of the religious right on the thinking of President Bush. Terry Schiavo was in a persistent vegetative state for 15 years. Her heart and lungs were able to function without medical intervention. She was being maintained by intravenous nutrition and hydration. Her husband made the determination to end this extraordinary intervention and allow her to die. Her parents opposed this decision and went to state court in Florida for an injunction forbidding Mr. Schiavo from taking this action. The court ruled that Florida statutory and common law allows such action, but the parents persisted in opposing the action and brought the case back to court several times. Then in March 2005, the White House and its congressional allies inserted themselves into the controversy. Their actions underscored the blatant inconsistency of their political principles when it comes to promoting their religious agenda. They constantly moan about overreaching federal courts. They argue that issues like Ten Commandment displays in courthouses, gay civil rights, reproductive rights, and religion in public schools should be resolved in state courts. That's exactly what happened in the Schiavo case. A local judge, George W. Greer, in Pinellas County, oversaw most of the litigation, and the Supreme Court of Florida upheld his ruling as being consistent with Florida law. When Judge Greer issued a ruling that Bush and his religious right constituents did not like, they forced the matter into federal court. In mid-March, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay called his congressional colleagues back from vacation to pass legislation he hoped would reverse the Florida court-ordered removal of Schiavo's feeding tubes. The bill forced a new start in legal proceedings in her case and switched those proceedings from Florida courts to federal courts. President Bush said this was necessary to prevent courts from making quick decisions without sufficient judicial reflection. This was while ignoring the fact the case had been in and out of Florida courts for years with a reasonable number of appeals on all contested issues, such as medical care and guardianship. The courts consistently made the same decision, a decision that held up the statutes enacted by the Florida legislature. In the end, the efforts of the president and the religious right were for naught. The federal courts rebuffed them. Stanley F. Bush, Jr., a conservative federal court appeals judge who was appointed by President H.W. Bush in 1990, blasted Congress and President H.W. Bush for intervening. He asserted that both have acted in a manner demonstrably at odds with our founding fathers' blueprint for the governance of a free people, the Constitution. The behavior of President Bush and the radical Republican leadership in Congress in the Terry Schiavo case provides all Americans with an up-close look at the dangers of imposing the theology of one religious faction on all citizens. This was obviously a heavy-handed government intervention in what should have been a personal family matter. The Schiavo case illustrates the importance of constitutional injunctions against the entanglement of government and religion, and an indictment of the Bush administration abridging the constitutional protections of religious liberty.
Our next speaker is author Denise Giardina. Mississippi has Eudora Welty and Alice Walker. West Virginia has Pearl Buck and Denise Giardina. Denise grew up in a coal camp in McDowell County. She has a BA degree in history from West Virginia Wesleyan and a Master's of Divinity from Virginia Theological Seminary. She has written five novels, Storming Heaven with a Discovery Selection of the Book of the Month Club, and received the 1987 W.D. Weatherford Award for the best published work about the Appalachian South. The Unquiet Earth, 1992, received an American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation and the Lilia Smith Award for Fiction, which is the oldest literary award of the South. Saints and Villains received the 1999 Boston Book Review Fisk Fiction Prize and was a semifinalist for the International Dublin Literary Award. Denise has published in The Nation, Southern Exposure, Emmy, and The Village Voice, among others. West Virginia Public Television filmed her screenplay, The Gift Horse. Her topic is freedom of expression and the Bush administration.
Thank you. I was looking at this tonight's topic, actually, as I was sitting there listening to others too, and it struck me that the people, the Constitution, and the Bush administration. I just kept thinking of the old Clint Eastwood spaghetti western, you know, the good. Except I want to tweak it a little bit: the good, the better, and the ugly. I'm going to focus on the first one tonight: the people. Because talking about free expression, and that's all of us. I'm a fiction writer, and also teach English here at State, and my department chair's back there. So I think I should use the word metaphor and say I want to start with a metaphor about this situation, because the way I look at it, just picture a pile of kindling that someone has put out, first of all. And then somebody else comes along and sprinkles gasoline on that pile of kindling. And then somebody else comes along and drops a match on it. And I think the Bush administration's role in all this is dropping the match on that pile of kindling and has set a conflagration that we are living with now. But I don't think the Bush administration put the pile of kindling down there or sprinkled the gasoline on it. And when I try to pinpoint who did that, I have to start looking in the mirror, first of all. And so I want to focus this on what I see are the two places especially that are responsible for putting down that pile of kindling and sprinkling that gasoline. And I see it twofold in a general sense. First of all, what we watch, especially our media, and who owns it and the way it has changed. And our response to that. And the second thing I want to point out is our own actions and the actions of individual people and the sort of fear-mongering that goes on. I want to give a couple of examples. But first of all, just to say that I understand that there are civil liberties issues related to free expression in the Bush administration. I think as I was talking to Chuck earlier, who was reminding me of the situation we had here in Charleston, where the couple, the Ranks, were arrested at a Bush rally, which was supposedly a public forum, I think a 4th of July public thing for everyone, but was really a Bush rally, and were arrested because of what they had on their T-shirts. And it's obviously there are situations like that that the Bush administration has exploited, and stupidly, I think, and what a stupid thing to do. They should be called attention to, and they should go into the courts, which they have, and fortunately we have the ACLU and other organizations who are fighting to protect us when government oversteps itself. But what I'm concerned about is something that's not quite, maybe in some ways, not that it's easy to address those things, but it's direct. You know, your civil liberties are violated by the government, so you sue. You make a fuss about that. Somebody comes to your aid about that. I think we still have a situation in that country where that can be addressed. But I'm more concerned about general freedom of expression, I think, that goes in a sense even beyond what the Bush administration has done. Let me just give you a couple of examples that happened this weekend, actually, that were related to the anniversary of 9/11. A couple of things that you may have read about. One is, and you may have seen, ABC had a miniseries on 9/11. Which has been highly criticized because of its inaccuracies. I stand before you and say I write historical fiction, so I write about people who actually lived, and there are times when you have to make things up because you don't know what happened, but you only do it when you don't know what happened. You don't make things up when you know what happened. And that's not what ABC did. I cut a couple of things, printed things off the internet and from the New York Times. Here's one: FBI agents question accuracy of 9/11 series. These were the agents who were called in to be consultants quit because they saw what was happening and didn't want to be a part of that. One person said, "I'm Irish and I believe in ghosts. I don't want to be haunted." That was a great quote. There's another New York Times article which talks about one of the scenes that was in this dramatization, in which Osama bin Laden is cornered, and they're ready to capture him. He's there, and they're ready to grab him, and the U.S. government, Clinton administration, says, no, don't do that. I wrote a novel about World War II. This would be like me writing a scene where Hitler was, in the 1930s, had been cornered by the German resistance and they were about to knock him off, and then they called Washington, and Franklin Roosevelt said, no, don't do that. I mean, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about something that happened 5 years ago, and it is already being propagandized in that manner. Now, because of freedom of expression, and certainly I'm here to defend that, ABC has the right to put that on one level. On another level, what I think we need to ask is, why do we have networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, that none of us have access to, Michael Moore's documentary was sort of held up as well, but look, Michael Moore did this. Michael Moore couldn't get, it'll be a snowball in hell chance of Michael Moore getting on ABC. So why do we have a situation like this? Well, we have a situation where our media is more and more owned by corporations. And that's That's why we are getting the sort of situation that we have with that document, with that miniseries. The second one I want to mention is the documentary, which was aired by CBS on Sunday night, but not here until 11:30, which is past my bedtime. Why was it not aired here and a number of other stations, CBS stations? Because those awful firemen and policemen who were at 9/11 cussed. And we can't have our children listening to those policemen cuss, can we? So the second force that I see is this pressure from, and I'm going to stand up here and say I'm a religious person, but the pressure from religious people on our media and on our freedom of expression has crossed the borderline, and has crossed the borderline into censorship, I think. It's a censorship it's not the sort of censorship that we had in Nazi Germany. I think this is one of the mistakes that we're making is we're looking at our situation and saying, well, it's not, you know, it's the Bush administration's fault, and once we correct the Bush administration, everything's going to go away. No, it's not, because the Bush administration doesn't have to burn books like they did in Nazi Germany. The Bush administration doesn't have to have a single media outlet with absolute control where you go to jail and you know, get killed and so forth if you broadcast something they don't like. They don't need that because their job is being done for them, number one, by the networks, and number two, by us, the public, who put pressure on or not. I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't necessarily have an easy answer. I guess from one point of view, I just simply have to say, I have to keep saying what I'm saying, and artists have to keep saying what they're saying. I think the Internet, hopefully, is something that I see some hope in. It's certainly, there's more freedom of expression there, I think, than you find on our networks. And to some extent in our newspapers, that's getting worse as well. And I think you see self-censorship going on in the press, even in the Charleston Gazette and the Charleston Daily Mail, which, for example, would not publish the Danish cartoons that were causing the controversy in Europe, even though they were newsworthy. And yet you couldn't judge for yourself that newsworthiness unless you got on the Internet. But I think speaking out on this sort of thing is something we have to begin to do. I also think comedy is important. I think the freest, if you look at the networks and freedom of expression on the networks, the freest time and place is on Comedy Central from 8 to 9 o'clock and 10 to 12 o'clock. 11 to 12 o'clock. And I was thinking about that and why that is, and I was thinking, you know, I've never heard of a funny fascist. So I really don't have a concluding remark at this point except to say that, well, actually, I do have. When I look back on the history of where we've come from and this trouble that we're in, where do I pinpoint it starting? Actually, I think it started right here in this county. It started right here in this county in 1974. And those of you who are old-timers know what I'm talking about. A fire was started then that has not been put out. You know, the gasoline was sprinkled on the kindling, and it only took the Bush administration to come along and throw a match on it to set it going. But actually, it's been building up since well before the Bush administration. And it's not something I see ending in my lifetime. And I think the only thing to do is to stand up and speak out. Thank you.
Our final speaker is Bill Goodman. Bill Goodman is legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. At CCR, Bill has led a team of attorneys challenging the worst excesses of the Bush administration since 9/11. Landmark cases include Rosillo versus Bush, representing the Guantanamo detainees before the Supreme Court, Arar versus Ashcroft, the first case to challenge outsourcing of torture. Other suits include a class action suit on behalf of Muslim men and Arab men caught in a post-9/11 immigration dragnet, which, in fact, was the first case to succeed in having a portion of the Patriot Act ruled unconstitutional. A suit charging Rumsfeld Gonzalez and other high-ranking officials with war crimes. A suit against private military contractors for torture at Abu Ghraib. And more recently, a suit challenging the legality of the NSA's domestic surveillance program. Bill is a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School. He served as president of the National Lawyers Guild in 76-77. And in 97-98, he was listed in the best lawyers in America. I included in his bio the topic for tonight, the worst excesses of the Bush administration after 9/11.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm stunned by the amount of interest in this community. And as I have traveled around the United States all over in this subject, people are not only interested and not only passionate, they are worried. And with that in mind, Eve described for you some of the work that we have done at the Center for Constitutional Rights since 9/11. In our view, it was the view of the Center for Constitutional Rights immediately after 9/11 happened that this would become an opportunity for a loss of democratic rights. And it was not hard to identify those issues and cases as they came along, and they came along pretty fast. As was mentioned, Muslim men within the New York community and throughout the United States began to disappear because they were being picked up, and relatives and family both within the United States and outside started to call us and say, can you find so-and-so, can you find so-and-so? And it wasn't hard to find them because they were collected primarily in the New York area, in the Passaic County Jail in New Jersey and in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. And to start talking to these people, there were estimates range between 1,000 and 2,000. I think it's closer to 2,000 people who were picked up under this program, who were in the United States sometimes and often illegally. In other words, they had overextended. They'd stayed beyond their visa. They were working off papers. They were deportable, in other words. And then they were ordered deported, and then they were held and held and held for months and months and months. They were physically mistreated, and they were held pursuant to a criminal investigation, but they were never charged with a crime. They were never brought before a judge or a magistrate, and ultimately, when they were all determined to have been totally innocent of any terrorism, not one of these men was ever charged with any crime involving terrorism whatsoever, they were deported. But their constitutional rights were blatantly violated in a number of ways, and it's not just me that says that. This was reported in a report of the Inspector General, the Office of Inspector General in the Department of Justice. This is an official government statement as to what happened to these men, and yes, we have litigation around it. So the fact that we're worried is, it seems to me, disturbing. The fact that people throughout the United States are worried. But the fact that people of courage within the government itself are worried. Members of the Judge Advocate General's office who testified in Congress about what is wrong with the military commission system at Guantanamo, with the way in which people are held, with the CRSTs at Guantanamo, and who have testified against the new proposed legislation, which is Congress rolling over and playing dead for a voracious administration, which is bound and determined to destroy the Constitution wherever it can, Those are people of courage. So is the Office of Inspector General of the Department of Justice that found the actions that I mentioned in the Turkmen case to have occurred and to basically verify everything I just said about what happened to those men immediately after 9/11. All of these things, I'll talk about the Arar case in just a moment, but I'm not here to describe the docket of the Center for Constitutional Rights. I want, in a few minutes, just to draw a picture for you. If you step aside from the somebody left a copy of the Constitution in front of my chair tonight, which I appreciate. I always like to see my favorite document. But if you step back from this document and ask yourself what we all know, what we know in our lives, in our families, in our workplaces, in our schools, in our communities, what is democracy? We all can define it. It is basically a very simple series of propositions. What is a democratic society or community? One, it's governed based upon choice, upon free, fair elections, in which votes are freely cast and in which votes are fairly counted. Two, people can't be arrested without a reason to arrest them. There has to be what's called probable cause in the Fourth Amendment. Three, you can't charge, you can't hold somebody without charging them with a crime. You can't just hold people indefinitely the way those men were held immediately after 9/11. You have to charge people with a crime if they're being held pursuant to a criminal investigation. And you get a hearing in front of a judge, an independent magistrate, a check on the government, on the police. And at that hearing, the police have to say, yes, we're holding him. Here's the evidence we have. And if they don't have it, the judge has to say, let him go. They can't be held indefinitely. They can't be tortured. People cannot be tortured, right? And people can't be discriminated against. You can't single people out because of their race, because of their religion, because of their ethnicity. And as a check on the powers of arrest, I'm sort of skipping around here, we have the ancient right of habeas corpus, which goes back to the 13th century. And before the 13th century, but it was put into writing in the 13th century in the Magna Carta, 1215, which says if the government does these things, if they hold you indefinitely, if they arrest you without probable cause, if they don't charge you with a crime, and by the way, if they torture you, you have a right to go in front of a judge, a magistrate who's independent of the king, right? King John, remember him from the Robin Hood movies, right? And you have a right to demand that you be let go, and or that they show this magistrate what they're doing, and that magistrate then has the power to say to the king, you can only go so far. That's habeas corpus, which, by the way, is about to be stripped starting at Guantanamo, and Congress is rolling over and rubber stamping what the administration wants to do, and federal courts, for the first time in the history of this country, Congress is proposing passing legislation which will strip federal courts of the right of the right or the power to adjudicate rights of habeas corpus, applications for habeas corpus. Presidents have done it in the past. It's been pointed out this is the first time that Congress has done it on a broad scale, and it's just the beginning. I would say, in addition, a major right is the right of privacy, the right not to be overheard in our telephone conversations, the right not to have our houses and persons invaded and searched and seized without probable cause. And the basic fundamental right, which is the right or the right of the citizens to have a government in which one branch of the government checks the power of another branch of the government. Now, if you take a look at that I'm sure I've missed some. I missed freedom of speech. I'm sorry, I forgot about that. We have the right to protest also. But every one of those rights, in greater or lesser ways, has been profoundly impacted by this present government. And it has done so in ways which have already been discussed. The NSA program, the wiretapping program, huge violation of the Fourth Amendment, not to mention separation of powers, not to mention congressional legislation already existing, the FISA legislation. Torture. Let's talk about torture for a moment. The case of Arar versus Ashcroft was mentioned. Meher Arar, is a man who was born in Syria and who left Syria at the age of 13 and moved to Canada. In Canada, he was educated, he went to university, he became an engineer, he started a business, and in 2002, Meher and his family traveled to Tunisia. He traveled back on vacation. He traveled back from Tunisia and stopped, changed planes at Kennedy Airport to go to Ottawa. And at Kennedy Airport, he was arrested, we think because his name was confused with someone else. He was arrested, stopped by the immigration authorities, and then interrogated by the FBI at length for almost 2 weeks. And finally, at the end of that interrogation, he was deported. But he was not deported. He was not deported to Canada, where his family was, where his business was, where his home was, where he had been educated and where he had grown up. He was deported to Syria. Now, in Syria, he was placed in a jail cell which was underground, which was the size of a human grave, where he was beaten routinely and regularly every day for close to a year and interrogated. And the questions that he was asked over and over again were the same questions which the FBI agents had asked him when he was held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. Mr. Arar has sued John Ashcroft and leadership within the Justice Department and the FBI and the agents who handled him during the period that he was in the United States for those actions and for torture. The important and tremendously disturbing thing about his case is the response of the federal government to this. Number one, you can't sue us because this involves national security, and therefore this is an area of litigation that raises political questions. The courts cannot get into this. We basically can do whatever we want when it comes to the war against terrorism. Number two, that can include torture if we choose to do it. Number three, if we hand someone off and franchise the torture out to the Syrians, then we're not responsible for it. Number four, you can't sue us anyway because of the state secrets doctrine, which was already mentioned tonight. We're not going to tell you what's involved. It involves a state secret. Too bad. And the judge basically has bought those arguments and dismissed the case. This case is now on appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. As I said, the disturbing thing, one disturbing thing, is that the judge agreed with it. But what is so much more disturbing is that our government, your government, and my government actually stood up in court and made those kinds of arguments. The kinds of arguments, I'm not going to get into fascism or Hitler or anything like that, but I certainly would expect those kinds of arguments from Darth Vader, right? I mean, this is not democratic government. Wiretapping has already been discussed, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. Free speech has been alluded to. You cannot engage in a robust demonstration in this country where a major political event is going on. You will be put in something that only George Orwell would have thought of until the Bush administration, something called a free speech zone, which is exactly the opposite, because I was in New York City. I saw the free speech zone for the Republican convention in 2004. It was where no one could see anybody. It was off in some back alleyway near Madison Square Garden. And people who did then say, this is no good, we're just going to, you know, go to Union Square and scream like hell. Or we're going to go try to go to Central Park and do the same thing, or the steps of the New York Public Library on Fifth Avenue. Those people were arrested. And there was a huge delay in charging them with any crime. Eventually, almost none of them were convicted of anything. But they were held in something that looks like Bagram Prison at Pier 57 on the Hudson River until the president of the Republican Party left New York City. So just as one emblematic example, and that was, by the way, close to 2,000 people also, ironically. Now, I'm sure I'm running out of time here. Just want to say a couple of things. Have any of you seen the movie Good Night and Good Luck? It's about Edward R. Murrow in the 50s. Well, if you have seen it, you will understand what I'm about to say. And if you haven't seen it, please do so. The message of that movie, and it's the message that I want to end on tonight. The message of that movie, and it's about the 50s, it's about Joseph McCarthy and the McCarthy period, it's about the effects and of a similar period, although in many ways very different to the present one, upon the consciousness of the public and the way people respond. And there are three things I think that movie tells us, three things that can destroy democracy. One is fear, and another is secrecy, and the third is silence. And the only way we are going to overcome that is to eliminate the fear, eliminate the secrecy, and speak out and fight like hell. Thank you very much.
We're going to open for questions now. We're passing out the cards, and if you have questions, please write them, and we'll bring them up, and the panel will answer them. If you'll determine which panelists you would like to direct your question to, if you put that on, we'll make sure we direct it to the right panelist. And I want to remind the panel, we'll have to come up here to answer because we need to speak into this microphone for our friend's recording. No, because we have to speak here also. Otherwise,
we can pass both. If we want to do the two hands.
Would you like to do two hands? Well, all right. I have the first question, and it reads, the root cause of these constitutional abuses date back to March 9, 1933, and the passage of the Emergency War Powers Act, which to date has been endorsed by every president since. All of these presidents have shown no willingness to give up these dictatorial powers. How can we, the people, and our elected senators and congressmen reclaim our lost rights? Who would like to take that one?
Take over. I don't mean to be facetious about that, but I think that there is an act of Congress, and it's not one that the Supreme Court is going to review in any likelihood because of various political question doctrines and other difficulties bringing such cases. And so the only way to address it is, I think, go back to Congress. And for that to be effective, you have to put your Congress into office.
Next question to either panelist. Do you see any point of hope? How can we develop such points of hope? Who would like to take that one? Somebody hand you the mic? Or would you mind coming up? Who would like to address hope? I hope somebody will. I think we're short on hope, but we're fighting like hell.
Actually, I think it's the same answer as the last one. Take over.
Exactly. Go to the street. Do you think there's a case for impeachment of this administration? Who would like to take that one?
We, at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we've actually written a book called Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. And those articles are, I think we have essentially four articles, one of which is, I think, the clearest, most illegal conduct is the wiretapping, because the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which Bob mentioned earlier, says not only that you have to go to a judge and get a warrant before you can engage in this kind of activity, but that it is a crime to do otherwise. So that's Article 1. We also have included basically fraud in the sense of lying us into a war. Torture and indefinite detention is a third because it violates all sorts of laws, all sorts of international conventions, convention against torture and otherwise. And finally, violation of the basic, the widespread violation of the basic doctrine of separation of powers. Now, these constituents of a series of articles of impeachment, I think, are just the beginning. You could certainly talk about Katrina, about the breach of government's general responsibility to protect its people, the kinds of things that Chuck talked about in terms of the First Amendment and the separation of church and state, those kinds of things as well. Yes, I think there's a strong argument for impeachment. I think that if we ever were to elect a Congress that had any real courage and substance, we could. This would be the strongest case for impeachment I can imagine. I mean, I'm not here to argue the Clinton impeachment, but that was really chicken feed by comparison.
This one is directed to Denise, and I think I knew the answer, but I'm going to let you answer. What happened in 1974? In 1974, fundamentalists in this county basically took textbooks out of the school system here, used violence to do that, intimidated, made the national news, disrupted the school system, affected the way textbooks are used in school systems across the country today. It was the beginning. Nobody had ever heard of Jerry Falwell until this happened. Nobody had ever heard of the Heritage Foundation. Nobody had ever heard of all these right-wing groups who are using, especially the religion, which Chuck talked about, to shut down our freedom of expression. That started in the schools, but it certainly has spread since to other areas of our culture as well. And so now, and I remember at the time, I was a young school teacher, just thinking, this is crazy, and how could this happen? And now it happens all the time, every day, everywhere in this country. And it's like, it's normal now, it's normal. It didn't happen before, and it started right here in Kanawha County. If you look at many of, as I said, many of those right-wing groups that now are household words, that's where we first heard of them. So that's what happened. And I just want to say, just backing up to the earlier question, too, about hope. I don't know if this is so much hope, but I think we have got to start saying, and I would say this to both fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist Muslims, if those may not be the proper terms, but I think in general, you know what I'm talking about. To say to both groups, you do not tell me what I can see. You do not tell me what I can hear. You do not tell me what I can write. Period. And that's free expression. I can vouch for all of that. I was a teacher in Kanawha County at that time, and I got death threats every night between 2 and 4 during the whole time. They were serious. This question is, how does one get the young people today to be more involved in the political process? Anyone have any wisdom on that? Yeah?
As someone who's teaching American government this semester and watching students go to sleep in class, it's a real challenge, you know. They think, what is this all about? It's so boring. You aren't even, you didn't bring your dog and pony or anything, and you expect us to be interested in this thing. It's a real challenge. And I think part of the answer to that is the answer to the hope thing. And I want to say something like Denise said, and that is we have to stop being afraid to say things that are going to be perceived to be unpopular. And one thing you can't do in the United States is to say anything critical of religion, because immediately, what does that mean? It means, first of all, you're a demonic person. No matter how stupid or ridiculous or ignorant the religious viewpoint is, you just don't say anything about it because it's their right to believe it. Well, it sure is their right to believe it, you know, and if someone in the government tries to interfere with that, I'll be on the front line filing a suit to tell them they can't do it. But that doesn't mean that we have to not respond to what they're saying. That's the other part of the equation. We don't want the government telling people what to say, but we don't want fear of criticism to prevent us from criticizing what other people say, which is a detriment, and many of the things they say are truly a detriment to the republic itself. So I think we have to do that. We have to be willing to not fall into this war mentality. The earlier question, what about the Emergency War Powers Act? Well, we have to take the unpopular stand to say this is stupid, this is wrong, and especially in wartime, we all know that the courts are very reticent to say anything against the government. And we saw that the most dramatic and egregious example is the imprisonment of 200,000 Japanese American citizens during World War II because they look different than most of us do. And even the ACLU didn't say much about that, I'm sorry to say. And we have to do those things. So how do we give young people hope? I think we have to set a good example. I don't know what it, you know, I'm a child of the 1960s, although I wasn't a child in the 1960s. I was pretty grown up by then already, but there was a different atmosphere then, and that atmosphere was one where a lot of people weren't afraid of what other people would say when they said what they thought was true and when they said what they thought that we should have, and mostly what they were saying is people should have the right to develop their own ideas, their own views, and students need to see that. They need to see that it's their responsibility, or young people need to see that it's their responsibility to develop values. And the current administration is saying, no, don't develop values. They're already developed. We'll tell you what they are, and you follow them. That won't work. So I don't have the magic answer, unfortunately. I'll turn it over to these other panelists. I'm sure they do. But we have to be concerned about it, and we have to set a good example, and we have to not be afraid to say the unpopular thing, to say the thing that's sure to have us criticized.
Well, I haven't thought about that. Here's my thought, because what I've been, the kinds of cases that I've been involved in are civil liberties cases, are Bill of Rights, constitutional issues. But it's clear to me that the rights that we have to be free from being arrested, to speak our minds, the rights that we have not to be detained and not to be tortured or punished in certain ways, this is a beachhead. The civil liberties and civil rights are connected with a lot of other rights that people have. And it's no accident, I think, that we live in a period of time when not only are this panoply of democratic and constitutional rights under profound attack, but also huge rights to people, as I mentioned before, to be taken care of in certain ways by their government. Public education is dying everywhere in this country. I don't know about here, but I assume it's true here because it's true in New York, it's true in Michigan, it's true in California, it's true everywhere, right? And so is organized labor and the right to fight for a job and protect your job. That's gone, you know. That's gone. And I think that what we got to say to young people, and there are young people in this room, if I would love to hear from somebody, one of them, is or more. But what we got to say to young people is, listen, you want to be educated, you want a job, you want to enjoy life and do all of these things.
And the only way you're going to do it is to fight, is to engage in the whole fight, which includes the fight for democracy.
Question says, President Bush called this struggle a crusade. Do you believe he really sees it as one? Anyone want to address that?
I'm not sure what he called. Read the question again. He called.
President Bush called this struggle a crusade. Do you believe he really sees it as one?
Well, I'm not sure what he sees as a struggle exactly. Definitely, the president sees all these things. Definitely, the president sees all these things in that viewpoint.
He's certainly, without a doubt, assured that what he is doing is right, and that therefore he has every right to call a crusade because, after all, the people who disagree with him are evildoers, and he's the one who's leading us to on the right path to the right goal. So I'm not sure what all he thinks the struggle is. Clearly, it's wiping out most of the people in the world who have any criticism of the United States. But he definitely does have that mentality, and it's a very dangerous mentality.
The first speaker spoke of sovereignty of the people. Starting with Bakley decision in 1976, sovereignty of the people, how do we restore it?
The reference was, I think, to Buckley versus Valeo, which was the first of the Supreme Court's decisions dealing with campaign finance, and the court hasn't been totally consistent in that area. But I take the question to be, is how can we, the people, take back the elections from those who appear to be buying it through large contributions and expenditures? Well, that's a good question, and it's being answered by someone who is not terribly happy with campaign finance regulation. I mean, I think it does present some pretty serious First Amendment questions when you start limiting the ability of people to spend their money to try to shape public opinion, and we run into all kinds of difficulties when we try to create level playing fields. And of course, in this state, we're dealing with a tremendous issue with regards to one person who wants to be king. You know, the man who wanted to be king was a Kipling novel, I think, but it's being replayed here in the West Virginia Hills. I'm not sure we can resort to that there are legal solutions to these challenges. I think they, you know, we're repeatedly responding to these questions with, we have to organize, we have to get active politically, and I don't know that there's a way to ensure that the people remain the real sovereigns without doing that. And of course, it's a whole premise of that same notion about the people being the sovereign, that the people. To be effective, the people have to be active. They have to be involved. I mean, that's as much a part of Jeffersonian and Madisonian democracy as anything. And that continues to be our response. Going back to the impeachment question, that's political, too. I mean, you look at every attempted impeachment in this country, each one was a function of politics. We were able to force Nixon's resignation because the political sentiment was that the bastard ought to go. The attempt to impeach Andrew Johnson was a function of the radical Republicans in Congress retaliating for what they perceived as political misconduct. The impeachment of Bill Clinton was all about politics because it was run by a Republican Congress that wanted to beat on him for lying about an affair. And of course now, I agree with everything Bill said, that there's a huge case to be made for impeaching Bill Clinton, but it won't. for a huge case to be made for impeaching George W. Bush. But it's not going to come from Republican Congress. So the answer continues to be you have to work politically to accomplish your ends.
Why do you think the administration is sabotaging constitutional rights? I would imagine Bush et al. See themselves as patriots. Do they not value the Constitution?
I don't think George W. Bush values the Constitution of the United States. When I talk about what defines democracy, you start with free and fair elections, and if you look at Bush, right? But you know, the problem really is Buckley versus Valeo is an important case to talk about. We have seen a corruption not only the political process, but of politicians as well. There was a time when you had people, even people who I hated, you know, people like, I'm not going to even mention names, but there have been times when leaders in Congress in both parties, on both sides of many issues, people who I would never vote for in a million years, understood the importance of the Constitution and understood what it meant for there to be an independent Congress, for example, and understood the importance of speaking out at certain times, of a declaration of war, at least a debate about war in this country, and understood all of those things. And this, certainly since the year 2000, it's not only been a lack of leadership and a lack of appreciation for constitutional rights coming from the White House, where I think they wouldn't recognize a Democratic right if it crawled out from under the rug and bit them on the nose. But in Congress as well, and I'm very sad to say, as a member of the legal profession, in the courts as well, although there are glimmers of hope coming still from the judicial branch. Humdan versus Rumsfeld was a very important opinion. It was 5-3. Really, it would have been 5-4 if Roberts hadn't had to disqualify himself. We're close there, too, ladies and gentlemen.
I just wanted to add, maybe I have too vivid an imagination. Maybe that's a problem with being a novelist. I really think we need to look beyond Bush. And I have a bumper sticker that says, it's like a Bush Cheney bumper sticker, only says Bush Satan, and I have, but I have this feeling, you know, if anybody ever asked me about it, I would say, well, it could mean Bush is working for Satan, or it could mean Cheney is Satan, you know, I mean, but it's actually interchangeable. I think we need to get almost beyond Bush and Cheney. I think and say who's really got the power in this world, and I was thinking about this because I was thinking of Don Blankenship, you know, coal and oil. And that is, I'm sorry, it's no longer Nazis and communists. Coal and oil are running this universe, this world. And that's who's in power. If you want to know where the power is, it's Chevron and Exxon. And Bush and Cheney are their lapdogs, I think. That's the non-lawyer novelist point of view, but anyway.
So
then I guess Tony Blair's lapdog of lapdogs. Why did the Syrians torture the Canadian? This puts them in cahoots with the U.S. Strange bedfellows.
Yes. Well, Bashar Assad, right? He's the... And who understands the Syrian government? I mean, there may be people in this room who do, but I know, and the dealings I've had, and a little bit I know about governments in Syria, Jordan, Yemen, Lebanon, a little less. It's only because it's the government is so precarious there. These are governments where who knows who's making a deal with what, who's promising what to whom, what they're getting out of it. I think this is the kind of government that we should be all afraid that we might become someday. Government that has absolutely the opposite of transparency, where you never know what's happening, why it's happening, who's beholden to who and who's paying who. I don't know why the Syrians tortured Mayor Arar. I know there's strong evidence that they were working at the behest of the Americans. I don't know whose back was being scratched, but this kind of government is, you know, a good example of good paradigm of the kind of thing that we want to avoid, and why we need more openness, less secrecy, and all of those kinds of things. But I think other than the fact that it was clear they were working for some, whatever their own reasons were for the Americans, I can't answer that question.
Misinformation and ignorance also destroys democracy. How are young people today, students, learning about the Constitution and their rights as citizens in a democracy? Anyone want to take that one on?
There are opportunities to do it. I think, again, this question is really the earlier question. How do we interest young people in doing that? How do we make them see it's important? And I don't know. I know that all of my students know almost every detail about popular culture, and I don't know much about it all, but they know very few details and even fewer principles of Republican government. And I don't know how we make it interesting to them. I wish I did, because I'm supposed to do that every day when I go to work. And when I say them, of course, that's not true. There are a number of young people and a good number of students at this university who are very interested in it, who come in and ready. But there is this other group which doesn't see the relevance of it, and there's still a lot of cynicism left over from being involved in politics. You know, it's something dirty. I'm too good for that. And the real reason is, it's too hard to do it. I mean, Republican government is difficult to do at the individual level, at the group level, and the governmental level. So, I don't know. I hope it doesn't take a crisis, an individual crisis, for those individual young people to realize that there is something important about these things. And let's hope that that isn't what it takes. But again, I think we have to set the good example. We have to not be afraid to speak out. We have to let them know that that in civil liberties and in civil liberties litigation, the government's always the bad guy as far as we're concerned. That's what we're in the business of, because the government all governments want to gravitate towards suppressing liberty, because it's easier to operate a government when there's less liberty. So we have to make students see and young people see that there's nothing wrong with criticizing government in the republic. In fact, it's an essential part of having a republic, to be willing to criticize government.
I hope I have this right. I'm sorry, my eyesight isn't as good as it should be. Comment on the Alien and Sedition Act, suspension of habeas corpus, where constitutional rights are established, and how. I'm not sure I've said that as it should have been. Does anyone know where to put a book on that one?
The Alien Sedition Act?
No,
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Alien and Sedition Acts, of course, were actually two statutes, one dealing with making it more difficult for aliens to become citizens and also facilitating the government's deportation of aliens. It was never an important statute and was repealed a short time later. The sedition part of that did contribute to a major debate about the meaning of the First Amendment, and it came back. The Sedition Act basically said you couldn't criticize the president or the Congress or so forth or bring them into contumely, as it said, and made criticism of federal officials a federal crime. And there were a number of prosecutions by the Adams administration of citizens who had engaged who had been citizen critics. Jefferson steadfastly maintained the act was a violation of the First Amendment. It was repealed shortly after the Jefferson administration took over in 1801, and then he then pardoned each of the persons who had been convicted under it. The Sedition Act returned during World War I when we reenacted another Sedition Act, which was applied again and upheld at that time by the Supreme Court, although it provoked a dissent by Justice Holmes, which has since won the day. And certainly there's no question now that we perceive that statute to be fundamentally at odds with the First Amendment. To the extent we see sort of sedition, anti-sedition efforts by government today, it's through far more subtle means, because we now know Congress cannot pass a statute that says you can't criticize the president, but we do arrest people who wear T-shirts criticizing the president, and we do fire people who appear to have engaged in a pattern of activity which is anti-government, and so on. And so it's just, you know, the tactics have changed somewhat, although there's, and certainly we don't have any kind of the broad-based attacks on criticism of the government. To my knowledge, the writ was not suspended at that time. There was an effort, of course, Lincoln suspended it to a limited extent during the Civil War, and there's a famous case on the protecting the writ decided by the Supreme Court shortly after the war, which said that it could not be suspended in places that were not in rebellion. And so as we see, and I think this was Bill's point earlier, we're now seeing inroads into the writ which simply have not seen precedent in this country. I'm not totally sure that's responsive to your question, Robert, but that's right, best I can do. Okay. There you go.
There is a statute now in Congress, and it's supposed to be reported out, I think, in 2 weeks, before the Senate Armed Services Committee, that will retroactively eliminate, strip federal courts, I referred to it when I spoke earlier, of jurisdiction in all cases alleging, demanding rights pursuant to the writs of habeas corpus. And this is jurisdiction stripping, and I believe it constitutes suspension of the writ, and I think it violates Section 9 of Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States. But this is for people who want to do something and want to write your senators here. This is, I think it's called the Graham-Warner Act, I believe, now is the current incarnation of this statute, and it's gravely dangerous, I think. Anyway, I did want to say one other thing about the First Amendment. There's a prosecution now in New York against someone who runs a satellite TV service, hundreds of channels. One of those channels is Al-Manar, which is the station of Hezbollah, and this person is being prosecuted for providing material aid to terrorism by broadcasting this TV channel, which I think shows the extent to which these terrorism criminal prosecutions are really undermining and eroding what we would have otherwise thought of as First Amendment rights.
Is America moving to being a fascist state under this administration?
That's a rhetorical question.
I'm brave. You may have heard the term friendly fascism, and I think that's what we have. I mean, again, it's not jackboots. It's not, you know, it's not the brown shirts out with their bonfires. It's not Kristallnacht, that kind of thing. But it's friendly fascism, and I think it is fascism. And it started before Bush. I'm sorry, I can't stand Bush, but I'm not going to blame just Bush. It started before Bush, I think it has to do with corporatization of media, frankly, and multinational corporatization of media and concentration of media, newspapers and television, and it is fascist. I think we're there now, and have been.
Please talk a little bit about signing statements. What are they, and what do you see as their impact on our separation of powers under this administration?
Signing statements are statements that the president contributes when he signs a bill into law. And I think the intent of signing statements has been to, and typically the signing statements draw into question certain aspects of the bill and express how the executive branch perceives the intent and purpose of the bill and how it should be applied and so on. They have become increasingly popular in the last several administrations, actually. I think they've been around for a while, but they've really become much more common of late, and I think George Bush, I believe, is on his way to setting a record for a number of signing statements. Some perceive it as a problem. Frankly, to date it has had, at least to my knowledge, next to no impact whatsoever on Supreme Court interpretations or federal courts' interpretations of the statutes. I mean, I can't say I've read every, well, I certainly haven't read every federal court case, but by and large, these have not had a significant impact that I can see in judicial application of the statutes. Obviously, an administration, if the president says this is what a statute means, his administration is likely going to go along with his application, but the next president can come along and say, well, I think that's baloney. And his administration can take a different approach. It's hopefully sometime or hers. And there are arguments that they are inroads into the legislative process, but at least to date I haven't seen it anyhow. Then you might have a different view, Bill. But anyhow, that's signing statements.
I have trouble pronouncing some of this questioner. Please help me. What about the judiciary, I believe? 2000 election, did the court thought contradict its own precedent? What course do we have in this case, and will anyone ever revisit this travesty? That's when President Gore didn't take office.
Yeah, that's right. The 2004 campaign was re-elect Gore, as I recall. Well, the Supreme Court, when it wrote that case, said this is good for one, this case only, and I hope that's right.
I think we're losing our audience steadily, and I think we may be losing the panel steadily. How about one more, two more questions? Let's see. Did not the president of West Virginia University establish free speech zones in that school several years ago? And is he a lawyer?
Yes, my boss is a lawyer. There was an effort to try to establish free speech zone at WVU about 5, 6, 7 years ago, I think, and to establish what it was somewhat euphemistically called a speech code. And it was beaten down. I mean, there was a considerable expression of opposition to the whole concept of free speech zones, which Bill says as well is a euphemism. And on restricting speech on campus in the ways in which the administration had attempted it. And basically the administration pulled it back, and we do not have free speech zones at WVU now. We, I think, have free speech.
One more. Let's see what I can do here. Question. What about King George attempting to usurp the state governor's authority over the National Guards and Reserve? Anyone want to go with National Guard question?
The answer to that is the Supreme Court actually said, Bill, 5 years ago in the Massachusetts case, that essentially the federal government controls the National Guard. And what happened in that case, Massachusetts wanted to do something, I think, to resist. Huh? No, it was after him. But in any event, the state governors cannot override the federal government with regards to disposition of the National Guard, is what it comes down to, I think.
Well, this has certainly been a lively and interesting evening. Thank you so much for coming. We look forward to more and more of the same. Thank you, Dan. Thank you so much.
All right. I just realized I probably said did not go out because, you know, different knobs. Okay, here's the deal. I need to rearrange a little bit of technology here, start up a little bumper music there, if you don't mind, Agnes, dear, and we'll be right back right here on the Head On Radio Network. I'll jump right in and we'll get going. I'm Bob Kincaid.
The Head-On Radio Network is brought to you every night by the Carpenters and Millwrights. The Mid-Atlantic Regional Council of Carpenters is a portion of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, or more commonly called the Carpenters Union. The Millwrights are a very specialized craft that perform their work with highly sensitive equipment and perform much of their work on machinery like turbines, laser alignment, and other highly specialized tools. We would like to thank the Carpenters and Millwrights for their support, because freedom of speech is free, and it's brought to you by the Carpenters and Millwrights, working hard every day to provide a brighter future. Thank you from the Head-On Radio Network. Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
This is Bruce Birch, and if you didn't listen to my last show, here's what you missed.
He knew enough to not go under oath because he knew enough that could have gotten him into trouble. Instead, he had an interview with the 9/11 Commission. They were stonewalling the 9/11 Commission. Why? Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they be up front and talk about exactly what happened? Why? Because they had something to hide. Now you tell me what you think it might be. You tell me what you think they might have had to hide. Only someone who has something to hide will try to avoid talking, right? Only someone who has something to hide will try to keep from being sworn in under oath. 3,000 people dead, and he couldn't bring himself to lay his hand on the freaking Bible and have himself sworn in to give a sworn deposition. Thugs, I tell you. Complete thugs.
Tune into my show 5 to 7 Eastern on the Head-On Radio Network and radiopower.org.
Wipe out the last hour or so with some questions for our panelists and a little bit of extended discussion, I hope. We're joined right now by Denise Giardina and Bill Goodman. Mr. Goodman, you're from the, as you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights. You're Denise, you're a professor here at West Virginia State. Professor Bastris, if you could pull up a chair for just a minute, I'd like to... I should have brought more microphones. Professor Robert Bastris is with us as well from the West Virginia University College of Law. I jotted down a few things, and I'd just like to get each of your thoughts. And first of all, to the two lawyers I'm talking to here, I have had an urge for a long, long time to try to get fleshed out for me, if possible. What in God's name is a unitary executive, and where is it in Article 2 of the Constitution?
Well, it refers to the fact that the president creates the cabinet and appoints those officials, and they are all beholden to him, in contrast to, say, our many state governments in which you have independently elected executive officers. For example, in West Virginia, we elect the attorney general, the secretary of state, the state assessor, and so on, and none of those officials is beholden to the president. unlike in the federal branch where everything...
Will and pleasure.
Everything is concentrated in the power of the president, right.
But it doesn't exist per se within the four corners of the Constitution, does it?
Well, there's nowhere that the Constitution says we're going to have a unitary executive, but it does give the president the power of appointment and puts limits on Congress's ability to make incursions on it.
Does an expansion of that doctrine, and I first started hearing about it during the Alito confirmation, does an expansion of that doctrine present a threat to the separation of powers as we understand it?
No, I don't think so. I think we rely on other devices and other checks to counteract the sort of the concentration of executive power in the president. I mean, in a sense, Article 2 does provide for a unitary executive because it says right in Section 1 that the executive power of the United States shall be in the president of the United States. And that's been interpreted to mean that it's creating a unitary executive. And so we rely on other devices to counteract any concentration of power there.
Okay. Then you know you remarked on a number of occasions you got to take the power back. You got to take the power back. Given the compliant I'm not just limiting myself to the Bush administration or these last 5 years. Congress over the decades has ceded considerable power to the executive. Is a real impeachment, even given a let's assume a Democratic majority, is an impeachment a viable? I mean, is that something we can even think about? I mean, is it realistic, or are we just hoping against hope?
Well, I mean, I think the legal case is there, and if the political will is there, it will be made. I mean, is the political will a viability? Yes, it's possible. You know, we elected by a landslide Richard Nixon in 1972, and in 2 years he was gone. And so if the American people become equally dismayed and angry at their president as they were in 1974, you'll see a movement to impeach him.
I hope right.
Well, I'm not a prediction.
No, but I mean...
But it's recognition of the possibility. Hey,
well, thank you very much, Professor Bastris. Have a wonderful trip back to Morgantown. Denise Jardina, you came at this conference from a decidedly non-legal angle, and I think that's valuable and beneficial in this debate. You see a lot of evil, and then let's use words like evil. I think we can. You see a lot of evil coming out of the corporate structure in America. And you were the first one who used the word fascist in this discussion. Are you convinced that we are in a fascist sort of mode here?
I think I mentioned that, you know, friendly fascism. I tried to make it clear that I'm not talking about the kind of fascism, you know, that we saw with Nazi Germany, where, you know, you have this wholesale murder. Mm-hmm. I think we are in an era of control and power, and the powers that be have figured out it's actually a lot easier to manage people without killing them. You know,
And it's easy. It's easy. It was one of the things I've remarked on during the course of the program from time to time. That arguably, life under fascism is easy. Keep your head down. Don't say anything. Mind your own business.
Yeah, and then you hope that the people that are running your system are making the trains run on time, as Mussolini was. You know, applauded for. You know, it works, and so we just all get along.
There's an assumption out there, and I think it was Upton Sinclair, Sinclair Lewis, that said fascism will come to America wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross.
I think there's an element to that. I think we're seeing that you know, that religious side of religious support of the religious right for the government. I think you really see. Actually, it's like a fusion of religious Americanism. you know, it's Americanism has become a religious model in a sense. You know, you go to churches and you see the American flag and vice versa.
It's a cult of state.
It's a cult of state, exactly. It looks different than Nazi Germany, where they had this whole sort of Teutonic, you know, pagan kind of cult going on. This is different. This is very American. It's apple pie and mom and Christianity. And it's scary.
I hesitate to call it Christianity, but
well, I do too. Actually, I'm a Christian, and I think it's basically debasing my faith, frankly. But,
Bill Goodman, I know you've got to get out of here, but I want to ask you just a quick question.
Yeah, sure.
Based on the work that you're doing with the center, if Congress capitulates and basically enshrines in law. Everything, you know, all the secret nastiness that George Bush has been about. Where does that leave an organization like yours?
Well, we're lawyers, so there are always lawsuits lurking in statutes, you know. So I suppose if Congress now says that everything Bush is doing in Guantanamo is all right, that these are the procedures, in other words, the same procedures that he's using, which are virtually, you know, provide virtually no due process for people who've been torn away from their families, you know, for years and years, but Congress now rubber stamps that, then what we have to do is take that to court and say, this statute is unconstitutional. If it strips courts of jurisdiction to hear habeas corpus applications, it suspends the writ of habeas corpus, which violates Article 1 of the Constitution. If it, if it gives people no rights whatsoever to, you know, they can't stay in the room while the evidence against them is presented, or they can't call witnesses for themselves, or coerced confessions and torture statements that are due pursuant to torture come in, then it violates the Fifth Amendment's Constitution. These are things, and six, and these are things that we have to raise in court, and if the courts then rubber stamp what Congress has done, we're in deep trouble. Then at that point, maybe there's nowhere to go. Then we have to look for other means to try to protect ourselves.
Well, you know, the Fourth Amendment, among others, seems very plain. I mean, it speaks in terms of shall and shall not, and not a lot of weasel, not a lot of wiggle room in there. Is it possible that we could see an uptick? In popular support for that, or is it the same old problem we've always had that, well, you know, those are just loopholes for the criminals?
I think there's both things. I think, you know, I think there are people in this country, many people, many millions of people, who are very frightened and worried about this loss of rights. But there are people who view courts just another headache. I mean, this is a president who hates judges, who hates courts, who hates someone saying you can't do that, you can't go there. So that's, you know, there's a clash of values in this country today, you know, between constitutionalists and people who believe in democracy and those people who would rather forget about those things.
Yeah, because American Idol's on next week.
That's right.
Has your organization, you know, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, we saw the admissions come out from the Homeland Security people that they had begun setting up these so-called detention facilities. Is your organization following those, following the development of those facilities?
Well, yeah, we're doing some work we are following that a little bit. I mean, once they get built, then we'll see. I think that this was some huge amount of money, as I recall, they were talking about.
And stunning amounts of land.
Yeah, thousands and thousands of new detention cells and so on. Yes, of course we're following it, and yes, of course. You know, it's more litigation, which really isn't an answer. If you start a lawsuit because someone's being held illegally, that means you're 2 years away from any resolution of their case.
That's
2 years gone out of someone's life.
Yeah, Mr. Hamdan comes to mind. I'll be interviewing an author of a book on Guantanamo detention 2 nights from now, a British gentleman by the name of Mozambique.
Oh, Mozambique, yes. He was one of our clients.
ask him about CCR.
I will ask him because it's a fascinating story he tells, and yet the man retains, and I would not expect this of someone who had been put through what this man's been put through. He remains he retains a real compassion for the American people.
Yeah. Well, there are some beautiful people out there who can do things that I would never do and who can forgive at levels that I never could.
But for your part, you just keep fighting, right?
Yeah, that's really right.
is there a website where people can go to learn more about the Center for Constitutional Rights?
www.ccr-ny.org.
Wonderful.
Thanks.
Wonderful. Mr. Goodman, thank you very kindly.
Thank you for your
thoughts this evening.
You bet.
Bye now. What do you think? What do you think? An evening like this tells me that there is a sea change beginning in the United States. I didn't know what kind of a group to expect, what kind of a crowd to expect. And lo and behold, we started out in one room and they had to peel back the walls because there was an overflow crowd. We had over 100 individuals in here tonight who wanted to hear about the interrelationship between the Constitution, the people, and what George Bush is doing to it. A question was put earlier, how do you engage young people? Is there time, is there room for hope? I would submit to you that in rooms like this, and it's not just here in the Kanawha Valley, but in rooms like this across the country, these discussions are beginning to take place. These inquiries are beginning quietly. And that is cause for hope. Now, we rant and we rave and we rail and cuss and carry on any given night of the week about the wrongs that we perceive in this nation. And I make a point of saying I don't give marching orders. But you know what? If you've got a chance to attend something like this, go out. Showing up is half the battle, and you cannot win if you do not play. The events like this are where the rubber meets the road. This is democracy in action. This is civics. There was a broad range of age here this evening, from older folks all the way down to younger ones. And that should give us hope. Let me see if I can get Professor Smith over here. Professor Smith. Could you take a moment on the air? And, of course, by the way, if you want to get involved with the program, the phone number is 877, the number 4, head on, 877-443-2366. When things quiet down a little bit, we'll take some phone calls, things like that. Professor Chuck Smith, Political Science Department here at West Virginia State University, you're sort of the host of this in a way. Thank you very kindly for helping out with all of this and for your kind and your remarks this evening.
Well, we're happy to do it, and of course that's one of the functions of a university, to have forums like this where people can come and have a free expression of ideas, and so we're very happy that people were able to come, and we're especially pleased with the grand turnout. We had far more people than we anticipated.
It was nice to see the wall get rolled back, wasn't it? And there was, as I was just noting, there was a broad range of age in here this evening as well. That's inspiring, too.
Mm-hmm. I believe it is.
One of the things that was addressed was motivating young people, and I know that's got to be a central focus of yours on a day in and day out basis. Do you find in the course of teaching your classes that in a place like West Virginia, some places call themselves the buckle of the Bible Belt, maybe we're the whipping end of it, is it tough to overcome that kind of entrenched, do you see a lot of entrenched fundamentalism coming through your classrooms?
You do, but it's not dominant at all. And like most religious fundamentalism in the United States, it's a minority position which has a very vocal element to it. Oftentimes you'll have students who raise things from a religious perspective, and oftentimes it's appropriate, but I would say that we have far less people being intolerant in presenting this than we used to. I mean, and maybe we've learned to deal with it better, but when people say, well, so-and-so shouldn't be able to do this, or we shouldn't allow so-and-so to do this because it's against religion, but what they mean is it's against my religion. Increasingly, the majority of the students in a classroom where there's some kind of discussion about that will just reject it and say, you know, we don't accept that, it's not our religion, and we don't feel any obligation to respond to your criticisms of us because we don't live up to your religion.
Well, what about attitudes as to race, gender, sexual preference? Is there a greater tolerance in the younger generation? Boy, in the younger generation. Do you see change coming from the ground up that way?
I do, especially in several areas. In racial tolerance, there's a change that's taken place that we don't even recognize because we continually see some instances of intolerance and discrimination and so on and so forth. But in fact, students are much more racially tolerant than they used to be, at least on the social and level. I would say the biggest change is attitudes about women. That the acceptance of women as full and equal members of the society is much greater now even than it was, say, 14, 15 years ago. I still think that probably sexual discrimination and sexual prejudice is greater than any other kind of prejudice in our society, and that a greater number of people don't take women's equality as seriously as they take all these other kinds of equality, like religious equality and racial equality and so on. But I still think we've made great advances in that area. And in spite of the backlash against full and equal membership in the community of gay people, at this university I see that attitudes have changed about that enormously, and that's not to say that there aren't students who genuinely are opposed to it and want to deny gay people rights, but in classrooms you just don't get this spontaneous, oh yeah, we're on your side, we can't have those queers.
You've seen
here.
It be worse, in other words.
Much worse, and I've seen a change right here in this university over the past 13 years in the classroom.
Now we're in the middle of West Virginia. I don't get this opportunity very often with an educator such as yourself to gauge or put a barometer on these attitudes. You know, you drive around, you see the stickers that say, "Oh, I'm a friend of Cole," that kind of thing. And this is, you know, this is a state university. You've got a high proportion of in-state students, and do you see attitudes changing in terms of the way we treat the environment here in West Virginia and as a whole?
I think so. Like most of these issues, it depends on how you frame them and how you present them. But in fact, I think almost all public opinion polls show that most people are very much in support for strong environmental policies. If you put it in terms of tree huggers and saving some small species, people might begin to think that's getting kind of silly. But if you talk about basic protection of clean air, clean water, and non-polluted land, almost everyone will go for that.
Is this a politically astute or a politically active campus?
Well, it certainly was in the in the presidential election 2 years ago, there was an enormous amount of political activity among the students on campus and off campus. I mean, a good number of people, students, were very active in political campaigns here in the Valley. And it certainly wasn't even close to a majority of students, of course, but I was very pleased to see as a matter of fact, we had two Democratic organizations, Democratic Party organizations on the campus, which were entirely organized by the students themselves. And right now, the college Republicans are very active. And these things wax and wane, you know.
Well, pardon me if I say that I wish the college Republicans weren't, but that's me.
Well,
and
no, but, well, I'm their faculty advisor, you know, and what that means is they need someone to sign off, and I would, you sure. know, I would sign off for anyone that wants to organize a group on campus.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the very heart of academic freedom.
And I give them what I hope is astute advice once in a while about what they're doing. I always point out I think they're going in the wrong direction, but that doesn't matter. And I found that we can do that here. I'd like to see more political activity. One of the difficulties on our campus is that we have a commuter campus, which means that most students aren't here most of the time. And for instance, the ACLU, we see enormous numbers of students, you know, like 70 or 80 students on campus wanting to be active members of the ACLU, but it's difficult to have meetings of their chapter on campus or to get officers because they lead such diverse and fractured lives that they're all over the place.
One last issue, because I'm sure you've got things that you want to go and do. academic freedom. That's got to be something that's central to you. And you know, there's David Horowitz out there,
yes.
And he's trying to. I don't know. He's like an academic clan, if you ask me. He's McCarthyism with a smile on his face or something. Are you feeling any of that around here?
No, we aren't. Not on this campus. I know there's some students that get upset with professors because they disagree with viewpoints that professors express, but the college administration hasn't been threatened, and so they aren't even concerned about that, you know. And I don't think that they're aware enough of what's going on in the classroom that they even would know if something's going on that they don't approve of, because they're not interested in the academic part of the college.
I see. Now, I see you've got an AFT pin on,
yeah.
American Federation of Teachers. Is that something you're active in? Of course,
yes,
I know they're affiliated with the AFL-CIO.
Yes.
And
yes. We have over 50% of the professors at the university are members of the union, and we started organizing a little more than a year ago. We were effective in getting the first pay raise we've had in 4 years. After we organized, and we're interested in other things beyond salaries, although that's very important. But we'd like to see a lot of reform at the university as far as emphasis on academics and more resources going into academics and greater resources for the professors who are here to do real research and real academic work.
Well, this is a very pro-labor network and a very pro-labor program. It did my heart good to see the pin there. Professor Chuck Smith, thank you. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you for covering this. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been our pleasure. And any time you've got the email address, let me know. Love to come down and share in another one of these events sometime.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Oh, no.
No, that's fine. Heather, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Well, I'm grateful you're so responsive.
No, anytime, anytime. The fact of the matter is, the room has... I'm the room now. But that doesn't mean that we've got to run on. Agnes tells me that we've got callers on. David, calling from Maine. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing well, David. How about yourself?
I'm doing all right. So what are you up to this evening? I heard a lecture earlier, but I wasn't really sure where you were at.
This was an entire forum on George Bush, the and his impact on the Constitution. We're down here on the campus of West Virginia State University, and it's just been it's been an exciting, amazing little experience.
Hmm. That other guy, he was an advisor for, for college Republicans or something.
Well, he's the chair of the West Virginia State University Political Science Department, so they came to him for a sponsor, and yeah.
Well, I would have let him on a cargo plane that said GOP field trip and then taken them to Iraq to see what it's like. But that's
I know. Well, you know, that's kind of just me too, David, but because, you know, he mentioned the group and I sort of visibly shuddered, but it's academic freedom. And frankly, you let these kids go out and make their stupid mistakes and hopefully they'll come around and recognize the mistakes that they've made. You can't save everybody from their own stupidity all the time.
I agree with you on that one. I called to talk about the second part of Pathway to 9/11 because I said I would sit through it and watch it.
So the rest of us wouldn't have to.
But yeah, the rest of you wouldn't have to. Basically, it was a publicity scam, and I think Daily Coast, I even think Bill Clinton, everyone else, they really got taken for a ride on it because I don't really see it was, you know what it was? It was a John O'Neill, let's make him a martyr piece. You know, Al-Qaeda has Osama bin Laden. The left has John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and they needed a hero for this generation. They're trying to hijack John O'Neill no matter what he thinks of this war.
I'm glad you mentioned that because John O'Neill can't speak for himself.
Right.
Lot of people have tried to put words in his mouth.
Which I have a feeling, like from Odd Couple and Oscar, he's screaming down going, "Are you crazy?"
Yeah.
You know?
I know.
I don't think you would agree with the war.
Well, you know, I think David that and this is just general principle on my part. Had this mockumentary or whatever you want to call it been left alone to die a quiet death, God knows it probably would have, because I mean it wasn't that good in the first place. If everything I read is true,
it was
sort of ham-fisted, heavy-handed.
It was a soap opera. I think the Clintons, if they look at it, are going to go, "Why the heck did we go so crazy over this?" I think they just did good PR on it because basically they didn't even show the presidents. They showed stills of each president, and they made a. Richard Clark kind of looked wild-eyed, but other than that, it was really just, you know, the writer trying to paint everybody, any Arab radical as evil with the bombs and the mosques and the Islamic music and all of that, trying to tie it all together with that kind of imagery. But, you know, it's no different than watching, like, Rambo Part 3 or something. And
the fact of the matter is it lost out, David, the first night did. The first night took a whipping from Manning versus Manning or the Manning Bowl or whatever you want to call it. It took a beating from Sunday Night Football when the New York Giants took on the Indianapolis Colts, which, you know, was gratifying to me. It tells me that America still has its priorities mostly in the right place.
Right. I think part of the thing is that people – They keep your eye on this writer because I think this was a trial run for the Iran movie. I think he's being picked by the SCAFE organization. I think he's been watched for about 5 or 6 years to see how he would act. They're definitely going to funnel money into him, and they wanted to see how far his loyalty went with a movie like this, and what he could provide. Basically, the script, if he could provide a running propaganda team. Campaign for it. And the other thing I'd like to mention is that he really, really focused on Prince Masoud in Afghanistan. You could almost see like he was living vicariously through this character. Just reading quotes from him about the war on terror. I can't say his last name, so I call him Psy Guy. Psy Guy.
What are we gonna do with you?
I don't know, but anyway, Psy Guy to me, he was really just this. Everybody who gave PR to this is what I would like to say to all the bloggers and people. You know, if you tried hard enough, someone could have got a copy, and you could have seen it, and you could have gone. And when you're dealing, with escape organization, you got to remember, these people want free PR. And I saw America Blog, and that guy went crazy with like 12 posts in 3 days on it. And you have to wonder, you have to go, okay, when you say your piece about it, you should just leave it there. And that's basically what I'm going to do with this documentary. I'm going to leave it in the dirt after I basically just explain what it was I watched. I didn't really see that tremendous of a Clinton defamation. You have nothing in court, people. If you think you can take this to court, good luck with that. This was just a bad drama. You know, just...
Well, there may be some actionable stuff there insofar as words were put in the mouths of people like Madeleine Albright that she said simply never got said. That may very well reach the level, the definitional level of slander. I don't know that for a fact.
But who really cares about what Madeleine Albright says or doesn't say? I mean, make a movie, have her say.
Well, no, she does, David. I mean, it's not anybody going to sue on her behalf. If she chooses to sue, she chooses to sue.
I know. I wouldn't care if she said cowabunga, dude, in the film. I really wouldn't care. I mean.
Well, I don't think she would either, but it's what they're saying that she said that is. I mean, I understand, I guess what I'm saying. I understand individual outrage about this.
Right.
I'm not inclined to give a tinker's damn about what
you see what it
you
was?
Know the Clinton, so yeah so the Clintons got mad. I understand.
You
yeah,
see
th-
what
that's,
it is?
But that
you see what it is, Bob? Though they wanted this is my main point of watching this. They wanted the left to say ban it, and to me, I'm the opposite. I'm like, go ahead, show it. Doesn't even look interesting. Show it. Don't.
Well, I mean, I'm that kind of a First Amendment person too.
Right.
And you turn around and you teach around it. Of course, you know, but there's a fear there, you know, and I don't know whether I subscribe to it or not. About half the time I do, about half the time I don't, David. But there's a fear that anything, you know, if it's on TV, people take it for truth. There are people who think that, you know, the Survivor really is reality television. It's not. You know, there are people that think, you know, professional wrestling is real. It's not. And by then, the Democrats' fear was that people would take that, you know, take this and think that, well, you know, George really is a competent, and nobody in their right mind looks at George Bush and thinks he's a competent president anymore. That's over. That's so 2001.
But this to me was a lesson, and the lesson is don't threaten to ban something. Just voice your opinion and say, you know what, that's not really the truth, and you guys shouldn't do that, and you should be shameful or whatever, promoting something
yeah.
like that. But that's all you really need to do. I think everybody would react in that situation.
Well, it's the band in Boston factor,
right.
David. You know, if you could get, you know, if you can get people to talk about it, that means there's more people that'll watch it, and therefore that's a greater measure of success. So, you know, I understand that factor out of it. The part that I, you know, the part that I'm concerned about, you know, the Scholastic pulled its little talking points guide for teenagers. I was glad of that. But by the, you know, it's distressing on a corporate level that, you know, this thing can be put out there, you know, just in whole cloth. You know, let them make it. But by the same token, people are free to raise hell about it. I think that they overraised it myself. You know, if you'd ignored it, it was just bad acting. It just goes away.
You could tell that this Psy Guy wanted to be Prince Masood just by some of the dialogue he said to Donnie Wahlberg, or as I like to call him, the new kid in the CIA. He said, he goes,
So tell me, Kirk, can you get me the tanks that I asked for? And he was like, I don't think so, Masoud. Are you not men?
We are Devo.
There's like, no, we're not men. Yeah, Devo. You see, everything to me, like I said, people, don't pay attention to the director. This is a shell game. I'm telling you, pay attention to Side Guy. They're going to move him to do an Iran propaganda movie. And they're probably
going to... He's got a future.
They're going to probably try to do it in theaters. I'm telling you.
Oh, God.
I believe that this is their front runner. He's exposed himself. And I just want to say something about Side Guy. If you look at his bio, it says, he's proud to be a very close personal friend of Rush Limbaugh.
No.
Yes, it
no,
does.
No, no.
It says in his bio. Oh.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
I mean, they're so bad. See, the thing is, it's so bad. They're so bad. They're so paranoid. This is what I think it is. They're so paranoid that these people have to have a clear history. There can't be any gray areas. You get what I'm saying? So
yeah, I do.
They have to have, with a progressive, we're like, oh, are you progressive? Okay, come here. We don't care. It could be Osama bin Laden. Okay, come on in. Oh, wait a minute. You're a terrorist 2 years later. Get out of here. See, but with the right, there's like, so where does your loyalty lie? Does it lie with the GOP? Are you sure? Will you fall on this sword to prove your worth? Will you? And
are you not women?
Just to close it out, do you know who played?
Was there one of those Jim Kirk moments where the green woman looks at Masoud and says, you know, give me another of those kisses? What is this kissing, Jim Kirk? Oh God, I'm so glad I didn't watch it.
I'm just giving you the highlights. Guess who played George Tenet?
Who?
Kevin's father in The Wonder Years.
Oh. was there narration? Was there a touching overdub?
I was waiting for him to say Kevin and then to hear the narrator's voice. George Tenet.
That was the summer that George Tenet ruined everything for me in seventh grade.
I mean, to me, when you pick political characters like that and they have a pop culture, see, this is the problem. When they have a pop culture reference like the new kid on the CIA, I'm going to keep thinking Hanging Tough. And then I'm going to keep thinking Wonder Years. And I don't necessarily think Wonder Years. This is how my mind works. I think of Joe Cocker. With a little help from my friends every time.
Yeah, what would you do?
That's right.
I'm not going to sing.
I think of that performance that he did, though, when he's drunk on stage with a T-shirt. Or I think of Jim Belushi's performance.
Yeah, who did a damn fine Joe Cocker.
Right.
No, you're like an onion, David. There's layers after layer after layer of it.
Right. I mean, like I said, I'm just making a prediction. I'm telling you that Side Guy is... He's the front runner for the Iran picture. Look, like I said, for the people who didn't hear last night, Cyrus is an Iranian American who has pledged his faith to Islam. You see how this works, guys? Pledged his faith to Islam. He was run out of Iran. See, this is the backstory. He was run out of Iran by Islamic fundamentalists, and he moved to Colorado with his family. So. They're all right.
But you know, there's a bunch of stuff involved with that, David, because of course, Colorado is the home to Focus on the Family, and there's a whole. I mean, Colorado Springs has been utterly taken over by the right wing religion industry. Oh, there's all kinds of backstory. David, thanks so much. I got to roll on because pretty soon I'm going to have to start tearing this stuff down.
Oh, no problem, Bob. You have a good night.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Later.
Bye now. And from David in Maine to David in Tennessee. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm about to fire up the Frank Sinatra and the whole, it's a quarter to two. You know, I'm the only guy in the room now.
You're in a big room talking to people you can't see.
Yeah, that's about the size of it, and there's a mental health facility down the road where a lot more of that's going on.
Oh, geez.
Oh,
if your head starts bobbing up and down, I'm going to get really worried about you. Luckily, I can't. here's the short version of what that mockumentary involving Bill Clinton's presidency was about. It's just background noise. It's wallpaper for the right wing to remind that one person out of about 12 now that would vote for George Bush if he murdered Derek Jeter in the top of the second at Yankee Stadium. They just want him to have some other warm fuzzy in their head. Oh, yeah, there was that movie saying 9/11 was really Clinton's fault. They just, for that true knuckle-dragger, they just want that guy to have one more brick in his wall. And it also is grist for the Flimballs and the Hannitys and the O'Reillys to just grind on it.
My friends, this was great theater. It's a pity this was on television. This should have been a theatrical release, my friends.
Half of that fat drug addict's hours last week and this week will be some corruption of that into some topic that matters to America. Now then, I've got a question for you that occurred to me during this broadcast, and I, like you, I was thrilled to hear that there was a room full of people. It started out as, you know, a group of one size, and it sounds like it almost doubled, and somebody had to push back the curtain and, you know, plop open some chairs. What great news that is, but I want to ask you a serious question. I don't think it's completely paranoid, but this is a serious question. The title of that was essentially the impact of this presidency on the Constitution. That was the
The people, the Constitution, and the Bush administration.
So that was the working title. So somewhere on a website or a poster or the little plastic letters you stick between the felt rows in the library, you could have seen that somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's West Virginia University, a public place.
It's West Virginia State University.
I'm sorry, West Virginia State. Pardon me. I knew not to say that, but I did it anyway. Boy. 45 minutes or an hour into that, would you have been sitting in that room, listening to those questions, knowing what the title of that gathering was about, 45 minutes to an hour into that event, would you have been completely surprised and thought of it as never possible if three county sheriff deputies came in and for some, you know, vaguely stated reason said this group of people, this assemblage had to break up. Would you have been truly surprised if some way, somehow, that had been broken up based just on the title of it?
No, I wouldn't have been in the least. And I'll tell you something, David. I didn't mention it publicly here because I was invited to come down and share this with the world. And I didn't want to in any way offend my hosts, but I know how the Bush administration acts, and this was a large enough group that I would not have been the least bit surprised to know that somewhere in here was a plant from Homeland Security in plain clothes, or the FBI, or somebody in the DOJ, because, and you know, that's not any reflection on the group in any way. What that is a reflection on the fact that we know by virtue of discovery that has been released by the American Civil Liberties Union doing the wonderful job that the ACLU does, we know that these are the kind of groups that the Bush administration sends its ugly little fascist spies into.
I'm a fixed income retired individual. I will bet anybody that will post it honestly, we could never get an answer to it, but I will bet anybody one time. And if the entire crowd could be going through with a fine-tooth comb, I'll bet somebody $500 that a plant, a person taking notes, if not running a recorder, I guarantee you that event had a stooge in it. The way this administration has corrupted and beaten on and painted brown with the worst possible substance, our our country's icons of a truly Republican democracy. Oh, they were there. That person was there tonight. I guarantee it.
So I'm not just being paranoid.
Nope. In fact, a thought hit me, and I couldn't believe I was thinking it, but based on, you know, you show up at what's billed as a public gathering, and you've got a T-shirt on that offends somebody, and Secret Service people come out of the woodwork with a county sheriff in tow, you spend the rest of the afternoon getting rousted.
Oh, I know. All over America, you know, the 2,000 people that Bill Goodman was talking about in New York City that protested Bush and the little con when they renominated the little Lord Fauntleroy. Those people were held without charge, without bail, until the Republican National Convention was over, and then they were just quietly let go and nobody got convicted. Yeah, I was proud of Denise.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I was proud of Denise Jardina because there were plenty of folks here who could have said it, and God bless her, she stood up and said it is friendly fascism. It's fascism with a smiley face. And she's right, David. She is absolutely right.
Of course she is right, and that's what they're so afraid of, is little groups like this, because it ties directly into what you said. There are smallish groups like this that are the point of the spear that you are a part of, that you are witnessing, that you are fostering, and they know that converts, they know that awarenesses will be awakened by what happened in that room tonight. 10 or 15 people out of that assemblage will leave there energized and saying, you know what, I had no idea. My Lord, we are everywhere. If at West Virginia State on a night like this, a weeknight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, this many people show up, there are going to be people that are more active tomorrow morning, maybe tonight, because of what they heard and what they felt and what it triggered in them. And the Bush administration, the Karl Rove, the Norquist, don't want that because they know what kind of bright light that is on their vampire hide.
Yeah, they do. And do we get to the point where this kind of thing gets put down? I don't know. You know, we were quiet and we were polite, and nobody was screaming, and nobody was jumping up and down and hollering. There were clearly, I mean, if there were any wing nuts here, they kept it to themselves, David. I think they knew that they were badly outnumbered, and you know how it is with right wingers; they're cowards, so they wouldn't dare stand up and say otherwise.
And typically not well informed enough to, you know, actually debate. They think debate means
right.
Shout louder than the other guy. Shout louder, like you heard Rush Limbaugh say, debate to those people.
About the same way they speak Spanish. Scream the English a little bit louder.
You've got it. Well, I know you've got callers stacked up, I'm sure, and I'm going to get out of the way and let the field through.
David, thanks for your thoughts. I really do appreciate it. I'm glad to know that it's not entirely that I wasn't the only one thinking that there was probably a fink somewhere.
No, but when that one gentleman referenced, you know, re-elect Al Gore, there was that one guy in the third row that looked around and rolled his lapel up and said, they're doing the re-elect Al Gore routine, boss.
Agent Fred. This is Agent Doug.
Sitting
there talking to you. Yeah, talking into his shoe phone. Yeah, and there's another guy up here rolling tape on it, too. If mine don't work, I'll take his.
Exactly.
Oh, Lordy. David, have a wonderful night. Bye now. All right, rolling onward, Jim is calling in from an undisclosed location. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Bob. I was just listening. I hope you've had a productive night at your meeting, and I've learned an awful lot. And what do you
very interesting, very, very interesting, intelligent people here tonight.
I'm sure. And I understand y'all were talking about the docudrama that was on the last two nights.
Yeah, a little bit.
Oh, well, you know. Well,
I mean,
you know,
I didn't watch it, so, yeah.
I didn't see that much to it. I watched it. And, you know, I saw things on both sides of the aisle. The one thing that impressed me was basically condemning the Bush administration for giving Osama bin Laden $43 million and not giving it to the leader of the Northern Alliance before he was,
well,
he was assassinated. That's one thing they did bring out. I've got to give credit for that.
You're talking about the $43 million they gave for, what, poppy eradication in, like, May of 2001? Is that the transaction in question?
Right around that time frame.
Yeah.
And, you know, that man was sort of, was portrayed as a very heroic type, very charismatic leader who had really done a lot more to fight the Russians than Osama had, and I don't know how accurate all that was. I mean, you know, I...
Well, and of course, we know, Jim, that, you know, as far as that donation was concerned, the Taliban leadership was brought to the United States and feted and hosted in Houston, Texas.
But, you know, I'll tell you something. As bad as some of the right-wing religious people are in this country, and I've heard you speak of them, if you really want to see some right-wing religious people who are just totally intolerant and who will zap you in a heartbeat, go spend a month with the Taliban. And
they're nuts.
I mean, I'm sure they will probably give you a program of instruction that you'll never forget if you can ever escape them.
Oh, yeah, Jerry Falwell in a bathrobe, that's them.
Well, I mean, good Lord. I don't know, but anyway, I didn't see that much to the whole thing, and I really didn't. I just, you know, I guess I had tried to, I don't know, it's a matter of perception, actually, and your viewpoint and stuff like that, but I thought that they showed as much bad for the Bush people as they did for the Clinton people. That was my impression.
Well, I guess the overall question was how much bad was there for the Clinton administration, because, you know, after all, 1993, the first Trade Center bombing, those people are in prison for the rest of their lives. We did what we could Clinton did what he could or what they thought they could along the way. Saddam was contained. He was neutered, as it were. So the contention was that they just made crap up. But, you know, it comes and it goes, and there was the 2003 firestorm over the Ronnie Reagan movie. We'll forget about this, and we'll be on to some other piece of right-wing crap by sometime around the middle of next week. It's the nature of the cycle, I suppose.
This whole thing will be forgotten, and you'll have another Kahootek flaming across the sky. But
oh, God, not Comet Kahootek.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's what these things are. I call them Kahooteks, okay? I mean, they flash across the sky, and then people forget about them until another one comes on the horizon.
But maybe we can perfect the metaphor, Jim, by calling it the Kahootek swine flu.
Well, but be prepared now, my friend. Be prepared for some cake charges that are going to come out, and they're going to really be more devastating than this could ever think about being. You know what I'm saying? Between now and election day.
It's going to get uglier and uglier and uglier. I expect it, you know, it's like Wayne says, I expect it to just get nasty because that's how these people are. It's that simple.
Well, I mean, they are basically behind their Atlantic wall.
Yeah.
They know what's going to happen if that wall is breached. But
and God, I'm hoping for the breaching, Jim.
But, you know, like I say, let them remain behind their fixed fortifications if they want to. And we'll see how successful they are.
We'll flank them. All right, thanks, Jim. Have a wonderful night, all right?
Thanks.
Take care. And onward, southward, to the northwest corner of Alabama and the last little toe hills of the Appalachians, and our good friend, Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing good.
How about yourself? I've been enjoying the chat room at the Horn. I've been really enjoying it here lately. Some good people in there to chat with.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I enjoy. I would like to have done what I do with every program and watched it this evening. And, you know, I type a little bit during the show and say hi to folks and stuff.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, unfortunately, we've got an institutional bias against chat rooms, so I'm all firewalled off and I can't get in from here.
I'm not surprised. I really enjoyed Camp Democracy the other night. I got to say, that's one of the best shows you've done in at least I don't know, since I've been listening to you. I really, really, really enjoyed it.
Well, that gratifies me a lot because it was an exciting time, Chris, and I wish we had more time. I wish we could do it for a longer period of time. I'd like to, you know. We had that one day and we tried to make the best of it.
You know these rumors I'm always coming out with. I've been trying them out on the chat room, and the chat room seems to think that.
Are you rumor mongering again?
They seem to think that I can use them on your show, so here goes.
Everybody, all right, try one.
Okay, I'm going to try more of them.
Agnes has her thumb on the button, Chris.
Hey, Agnes is my buddy.
I know.
Everybody is talking about impeaching the president. Why don't we kumquat him or give him the banana? Impeach sounds a little too nice. What do you think?
Kumquat,
yeah. Karen Hughes can take care of that. Okay. Jesus. In a recent poll, Gallup, which will be even funnier here in a minute. Bush and Paris Hilton were the only two people in the country who thought that a standing O meant being entered from behind.
You're getting close.
Bruce?
She's reaching for the button.
Bruce? I told Bruce this is going to be for you. They said in the chat room the other night that I could do one about Karl Rove and a Samoan, but I don't know if I could get away with it.
Save it for another day, Chris. I mean, it's, you know.
But anyway, no, the 9/11 movie, that was, I watched a clip from it, and everybody loved Bush. I just couldn't. Everybody
yeah,
loved
I
Bush
know.
Badly,
yeah.
And I just couldn't see those two on the screen together, so I just didn't watch it.
You know, why? Now, see, that's great minds think alike. I saw Harvey Keitel, and I immediately went to the Bad Lieutenant.
Yeah.
And it just made sense for me.
So instead, I just went for some mindless entertainment and went to see Crank and had a great time.
Now you went and saw Crank, or you went and did Crank? I lost you there.
You know, West Virginia's not that far a drive away from me to come up here and just slap you up silly all around the room. And don't think I won't do it. No,
hey Chris, thanks a load, brother. We'll talk to you soon. I gotta tear this thing down.
Okie dokie.
All right, later. Mercy. All right. I'd say we're pretty close to done. If there's another call on there, go ahead and put the call through, Agnes, because I haven't had time to check the email, and I'm crippled without being able to feel like I'm flying blind in a fog in a mountainous region. Mountain. Okay, so there's nobody else on the line. It's time to wrap it up. I want to share with you a few words. These are the words this group that produced tonight's forum, Seneca 2, doing things as they ought to be. This quote on the back of the brochure, the back of the program from tonight, quote, "What happened was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to be governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believe that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. The crises and reforms, real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. To live in the process is absolutely not to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness acuity than most of us ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion regretted. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for one shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join you in resisting somehow. Suddenly it all comes down all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we did nothing. You remember everything now, and your heart breaks too late. You are compromised beyond repair. a German professor describing the coming of fascism in They Thought They Were Free by Milton Meyer. And I'm sitting here in an empty room in a university in the Kanawha Valley in the state of West Virginia. And I wonder, and I'm not trying to be overly cynical, but I wonder who among this crowd will go home and do something about it. Or, having been here to this meeting, will they think that they have already done something and that that something was enough? I will tell you now, it is not enough to come out and listen, for you must go out and you damned well must do. It is not enough for me to drive down here and share this information with the entire blessed world, for I must go and I must do. We live in a time when the word enough must be removed from the vocabulary. It is not possible for us to do enough. It is only possible that we must do until we can do no more, that this republic shall be saved. Okay? That's just me. The show tonight, of course, was produced by my lovely and talented wife, Agnes. It was announced by Brian Reznor. John Fox is the chief engineer of the Head On Radio Network. He's in Sydney, Australia. Ben Birch of WhiteRoseSociety.org maintains the streams and all the archives of the programming. Our good friend Shelby Lepre is our streaming partner at RadioPower.org. And we're proud to be affiliated with her. Peter Godbold of Godbold Computer Services in Tallahassee, Florida is our IT professional, and what a professional indeed he is. All the programs on the Horn happen for one very specific reason, and that is because there are thousands of members of the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights who get up and go to work every day, and they build the American dream. And in building the American dream, they help to support the growth of this network, and in so doing, perhaps help to save the American dream. And always, 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 RMR, it's all for you.
now, Mike Malloy.
Well, good afternoon. I knew I was going to do that. Good evening, True Seeker. That's all, folks. Good evening, True Seekers. Welcome, all of our new affiliates, to Malloy After Dark. You know, I've been accused of being a vampire, the Prince of Darkness, by some of my former right-wing talk show colleagues. I've got one thing to say about that. Program tonight produced, as always, by Catherine Bay. Robin Bittman is our announcer. Phone number here is 800-TALK-YES, 800-825-5937, or you can email during the program to Mike D. Malloy at earthlink.net. To the affiliates who are now carrying this program live rather than delayed, welcome. And to any new stations that may have picked up the program this early on in the program change, welcome to you, too. I'll get your call letters eventually, I'm sure. Start off tonight, this deck of cards thing, I didn't pay too much attention to it when the geniuses in the Bush administration came up with the wanted deck of cards for the, what is it, Kathy, 55? Must be a 52-card deck and three jokers or something. But 55 cards, or 55 names put together in a deck of cards.